Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, year-end review. As 2010 draws to a close, we look back at the events and highlights of the past year for Pope Benedict with the help of John Allen, one of the world's leading commentators on Vatican affairs. Thomas Becket, the Martyr. Listen to our dramatised story of Thomas Becket, the 12th century Archbishop of Canterbury, who was stabbed to death in his cathedral and whose feast day we mark on December the 29th. But first, we begin with a report by Chris Altieri on Pope Benedict's last Wednesday General Audience of 2010.
In the Paul VI Audience Hall on Wednesday, with thousands of pilgrim faithful in attendance on the fifth day of Christmas, Pope Benedict XVI held his weekly General Audience, during which he reflected on the life and legacy of St. Catherine of Bologna, a poor Clare abbess of the 15th century whom the Holy Father described as a woman of great wisdom and culture.
In her spiritual journey, Catherine endured her own dark night of the soul, experiencing doubts and temptation, but also great consolations. In her treatise, The Seven Spiritual Weapons, she writes of the many graces she received and lists the most effective means of resisting the temptations of the devil.
Pope Benedict went on to discuss how Catherine tells of the visions which led her to understand both the severity of the Last Judgment and, at the same time, God's infinite mercy.
Catherine's entire life was a model of humility and obedience. Indeed, she saw all disobedience as a sign of the spiritual pride which destroys all virtue.
The Holy Father concluded his reflection by praying that the example and prayers of St. Catherine of Bologna might inspire in us humble obedience to God's will in our daily efforts to remain faithful to his plan for our lives. Following the reflection, which was the latest installment in Pope Benedict's series of catecheses on great women in church history, the Holy Father greeted pilgrims in many languages, including English, during which he had a special word of welcome for the students of the American College at Louvain.
May this pilgrimage to Rome be a source of spiritual enrichment as you prepare for priestly ministry in the United States. Upon all the English-speaking visitors present to this audience, I accord and invoke the joy and peace of Christ, our newborn Savior.
I'm Chris Altieri.
...2010 is drawing to a close, and so it's time to take stock and look back at the past 12 months to revisit some of the main events and highlights of this past year for Pope Benedict and the Vatican. It was another busy year for the Pope, with five overseas trips, including one to Britain, a synod of bishops on the Middle East, the publication of several important papal documents, and the release of an interview book that shed new light on the Pope. But 2010 will also go down in history as the year where the clerical sex abuse scandal swept across the Catholic Church in much of Europe and elsewhere. John Allen is senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter in the US and is one of the world's best-known commentators on Vatican and church affairs. He is also the author of several books on the Catholic Church. I began by asking him whether he felt Pope Benedict and the Church had come out stronger after being buffeted by the clerical sex abuse crisis during the first half of 2010.
Well, clearly, the clerical sexual abuse scandals that washed across Europe, beginning in Ireland and then popping up in Germany and Belgium and in the Netherlands and other places, which also then generated very difficult questions, particularly in the secular media, about the role of the Vatican and the role of the Holy Father himself in responding to all that, made the first half of 2010 an extraordinarily difficult period for the Church. I think at the end of it, there probably is a stronger consensus today, at least in terms of those who were not church insiders, who had not followed the arc of this story from the very beginning, that Pope Benedict XVI has a profile as a reformer on this issue. That is to say, that however inadequate one may want to argue that the Vatican's response has been to this question, I don't think there's any serious doubt that the former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the man who is today Pope Benedict XVI, has always been on the side of pushing for a more aggressive response. I think the fruit of the crisis, so to speak, and you know, one certainly would never wish to, for a trauma of that magnitude to make something clear. But nevertheless, I think what it has made clear is the point that Pope Benedict XVI is a man who, from the very beginning of this crisis, who has tried to come to terms with it and who has tried to cajole the Church, so to speak, into a more comprehensive and satisfactory response to it. Having said that, I think it is, however, clear that this crisis is not over. That, you know, for a long time we have been wondering as Catholics, when will we round the corner on this crisis? In the United States, when it blew up in 2002, there was hope that perhaps by the end of that year it would be over. I think what is clear is that the fallout of this crisis is with us for some time to come. It is with us in terms of the internal life of the Church, the rupture of trust that has occurred. It's with us externally in terms of the massive blow to the Church's moral credibility that this crisis has meant. And so while I think it is clear to anyone whose eyes are open that Pope Benedict XVI has moved the ball farther and faster than anyone else at senior levels of the Church on this question, I think it is also true that there's a lot of work left to be done.
Okay, let's turn now to some of the more positive elements of 2010. Perhaps one that stands out, particularly for the English-speaking world, was his trip to England and Scotland. Now, that was preceded by a lot of fairly hostile press coverage, particularly in the secular or aggressively atheist sectors of society. And yet, it was a successful trip, wasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, you're right. There was this drumbeat prior to the trip, sort of predictions of gloom and doom. I mean, the whole thing was introduced by a flurry of speculation that the Pope might somehow be arrested and thrown into jail when he set foot in the UK for his role in the sexual abuse crisis. Others had predicted there would be massive public protests, massive blowback in the streets when he came to the UK. And of course, none of that materialized. The contrary, I think Benedict XVI, as he always does when he travels, I have to say, came across as an extraordinarily thoughtful, warm, and positive public figure. And I'll tell you, my window into that was, I was doing the commentary for CNN during the Pope's visit. And at the end of it, I had to stay in London because I was on the CNN set to do the color commentary, so to speak, for that day. And afterwards, I and a number of the CNN producers went to a pub around the corner to sort of debrief. And one of the English TV channels had the ongoing coverage of the trip. And we were sitting next to a couple of guys who were your kind of classic, secular, unchurched, fundamentally dubious about Catholicism kind of guys. And they were listening to the Pope speak about the positive role that religion can play in public life in the UK. And one of them said to the other, "Well, I guess he's not so crazy after all." To me, I mean, that symbolized, yes, you know, what a breakthrough this trip was, that a pope who came into the UK carrying some fairly significant baggage, let's admit. He was identified with a sexual abuse scandal. He was identified with positions on public issues that don't play well in some circles of English public opinion, who was seen as a kind of fire-breathing, finger-wagging, draconian moralist, somehow succeeded reintroducing himself to the English public as someone who was deeply sympathetic with where English society is moving and wants the Church to play a positive role in that conversation. To me, it was a real watershed moment.
Other foreign visits that the Pope made this last year took him to Malta, Portugal, Spain, and Cyprus. What stands out in your view about any of the things he said or did during these pastoral visits? Is there any kind of anecdote that you can share with us?
I mean, certainly the trip to Malta stands out because it was yet another occasion in which Benedict XVI met with victims of clerical sexual abuse. And I had the opportunity to interview a couple of those victims after the meeting took place. And I remember them recounting, while they themselves were weeping, talking about the tears the Pope himself had in his eyes when the meeting took place and how much they felt his pastoral concern for their suffering.
Were they still angry afterwards?
Oh, well, of course. Look, I mean, there's a legitimate policy debate to be had about decisions the Holy See has made or not made or how the local Church has responded. But beyond all that, I think the fundamental question many people have had since the outset of this crisis is, does the Pope get it? I mean, in his heart, does he understand the pain that this crisis has wrought for so many people? And I think for those victims, and now now there have been 5 meetings between Benedict and victims of sexual abuse. For those who have been in the room with him, had the opportunity to tell their stories to him and listen to him reach out to them, I don't think for those victims there's any doubt that the Pope does get it, that the Pope is personally heartsick about this crisis and is committed in every fiber of his being to try to do what he believes the Church needs to do to try to bring this suffering to an end. So I think that certainly that experience stands out. I would say the trip to Cyprus stands out largely because since he was elected, there is this kind of rap on Benedict XVI that he is excessively Eurocentric and concerned only about the vicissitudes of contemporary Europe. Well, Cyprus was a point of departure for him to talk about the situation that Christianity faces in the Middle East, and it, of course, was the prelude to the Synod on the Middle East, that is a gathering of about 300 bishops from around the world overall from the Middle East that took place in Rome in October. And what came out of those two experiences was how personally engaged and committed Benedict XVI is to the fate of the Christian community and the Catholic Church in the Middle East, particularly in places where, to be quite honest, the Church is getting its teeth kicked in, and one thinks immediately of places like Iraq.
Well, indeed, that massacre that happened shortly after the end of the Synod.
And I think it is incredibly important to have these testimonies of the Pope's personal commitment to not only the well-being, but the raw survival of Christian communities in those parts of the world where they are, of course, incredibly imperiled.
Now, this year didn't see the release of any encyclicals by Pope Benedict, but it did see some important papal documents. Let's talk first of all about the Apostolic Constitution, which set out a structure for traditionalist Anglicans to join the Catholic Church. I mean, how significant do you see that, and what waves is it continuing to make?
Well, I think the sociological significance of the document that created these new structures, these so-called personal ordinariates for former Anglicans, remains to be seen. We don't really know what the market, so to speak, is going to be, how many former Anglicans are going to sign on the dotted line. To date, there have been a few in the UK, a few in Australia, none in the United States that I'm aware of. And so I think it will take 2 or 3 or more years to know exactly what the quantitative dimension of this turning point is. But I do think it is, in terms of its symbolic importance, I think at the beginning it was to some extent styled and almost misunderstood as a kind of anti-ecumenical gesture from
Indeed,
the Vatican.
Indeed, that was the criticism that was
left. Some Anglicans, of course, saw it basically as the Pope fishing in their pond, that is, poaching for converts from Anglican, at a time when the Anglican communion is already in crisis, of course. But I think, you know, more reflectively, what has become clear is that this was an expression of Benedict XVI's ecclesiology, and it's an ecclesiology of unity and diversity. That is, he clearly is a man who understands that the traditional cornerstones of Catholic identity are non-negotiable, and yet he is willing to allow a variety of expressions of what that unity looks like.
Now, there was another event towards the end of this year, which, of course, got a lot of media coverage, and that was the interview book by the German journalist Peter Seyfried, which was publishing basically a transcript of a series of interviews with Pope Benedict. The media focused almost entirely on just one extract, his remarks about condoms and using them as a means to prevent the transmission of AIDS. But moving beyond that, or, you know, just not just focusing on that, what was your take on this book and what emerged from it? What new light was shed on the Pope as a person?
First of all, I think what it shows us is a Pope who is not afraid of tackling questions and giving answers. I mean, in a time when many of us lament a kind of perennial communications problem in the Vatican, in a certain closure of the institution to the media and so on, I mean, what we have is a Pope himself who clearly is not skittish about sitting down and entertaining the kinds of questions that journalists ask and giving very direct and I think remarkably open and comprehensible answers to those questions. So, I mean, actually, you know, if anybody were to ask me, where do you go for an object lesson in how church communications ought to be handled, I would say, look at Benedict XVI in light of the world. I mean, it's a perfect model of a kind of fearlessness when it comes to engaging the questions of the world.
I was speaking to John Allen, one of the world's leading commentators on Vatican and Catholic affairs. We now broadcast our dramatized story of Thomas Becket, the 12th century Archbishop of Canterbury, who was stabbed to death in his cathedral and whose feast day we mark today on the date of his martyrdom.
On a dark December afternoon, four knights of the court of Henry II rode into Canterbury in search of the Archbishop, Thomas Becket. They left him dead in the blackness of his own cathedral, and the common people came to dip their hands in his blood. Within hours, miracles were performed in his name, and 2 years later, he was proclaimed a saint and martyr of the church.
The quarrel between Thomas of Canterbury and his king is one of the most famous in English history, due mainly to the powerful personalities of the two men, who from being bosom friends became arch enemies, to the point that Henry wished Thomas dead, a wish uttered in anger and deeply regretted when it was granted.
Thomas Becket was born in London in 1118, son of a Norman merchant. As a young man, he worked in the household of Theobald, Archbishop of Canterbury, accompanying him to important European centres and taking time off to study canon law. He held several ecclesiastical posts, and then, in 1154, was appointed Archdeacon of Canterbury.
Thomas has been described by contemporaries as tall and spare, with dark hair and a pale face that flushed in excitement. Henry was obviously impressed by him, for he made him Chancellor of England in the following year. The two men understood each other so well, they were said to be of one heart and mind. So that when Archbishop Theobald died in 1161, Henry saw it as a golden opportunity to subjugate church to state by putting his own man in office.
But he had not reckoned on his friend's reaction. Thomas must have foreseen the dilemmas such an appointment would produce, for he waited a year before accepting the post. And when he did, from being, in his own words, a proud, vain man, a feeder of birds and follower of hounds, he was transformed into a shepherd of sheep.
He opposed the encroachments of the king on the liberties of the clergy and the rights of the church. When Henry ordered him to appear before the great council to explain himself, Thomas refused, denying the authority of the king and placing himself under the protection of the Pope and of God. He fled to France and stayed in exile for 6 years.
Then, in 1170, the king and Becket met in Fretteval, Touraine, and there was a public reconciliation. Or so it seemed. Both men, in principle at least, put their claims on one side. The king, for his part, made no mention of his rights and customs. What was more, he guaranteed the Archbishop a safe return home and full possession of his see, without demanding any oath of loyalty.
Henry and Thomas met once more later in the year, this time at Chaumont. They would not meet again. Thomas must have had a presentiment, for when they said farewell, he turned to the king with these words.
My lord, my heart tells me that I part from you as one whom you shall see no more in this life.
You hold me as a traitor?
That be far from thee, my lord. Adieu.
Adieu, Thomas. Thomas.
And so, to England. Whether to peace or destruction, I know not. God has decreed what fate awaits me.
Thomas was gone, galloping towards his destiny on the other side of the channel. He was not fooled by the king's acquiescent manner. The sooner he was back in Canterbury, the better. Once there, he would appeal to the Pope for unlimited powers of excommunication. That way, he could discipline his ecclesiastical forces. The more potent and fierce the prince is, he wrote, the stronger stick and harder chain is needed to bind him and keep him in order.
The Archbishop was given an ecstatic welcome home. In London, he rode through the streets in triumph, scattering alms to the cheering crowds. In Canterbury, he was received by his monks as an angel of God. But when he preached in the cathedral, he spoke strange words. I am come to die among you. In this church there are martyrs, and God will soon increase their number.
We do not think of a martyr simply as a good Christian who has been killed because he is a Christian. For that would be solely to mourn. We do not think of him simply as a good Christian who has been elevated to the company of the saints. For that would be simply to rejoice. And neither our mourning nor our rejoicing is as the world's is. A Christian martyrdom is never an accident, for saints are not made by accident. Still less is a Christian martyrdom the effect of a man's will to become a saint. As a man, by willing and contriving, may become a ruler of men. A martyrdom is always the design of God, for his love of men, to warn them and to lead them, to bring them back to his ways. It is never the design of man. For the true martyr is he who has become the instrument of God, who has lost his will in the will of God, and who no longer desires anything for himself, not even the glory of being a martyr.
But in Becket's absence, the king had seen fit to have his young son crowned by the Archbishop of York. Becket was deeply offended and promptly excommunicated all the clergy who had taken part in the ceremony. They travelled en masse to the king, who was in Normandy, and declared that the archbishop was ready to tear the crown from the young king's head. This sent Henry into a fury, and surrounded by his knights and nobles, he made the celebrated declaration.
What a pack of fools and cowards I have nourished in my house, that not one of them will avenge me of this turbulent priest.
The king's outburst had its effect immediately. The challenge was taken up. Four knights looked at each other and came to a quick decision. There was no time to lose. They left the court in secret and travelled hotfoot to the coast. Once across the channel, they called for horses and rode fast to Canterbury.
It was the time for Vespers. Thomas the Archbishop followed the monk carrying his crozier through the cloister, slowly, as in processional. He heard the chanting of the monks come from the choir. The storm had come into the cloister. Rain slanted in. A wind scooped down beneath the eaves and wet their faces and blew their garments wildly in the dark. The chanting faded and then rose again. Voices behind them. And the splintering of wood. The church was dark. Only the altar lights glowed in the choir, far away. Thomas crossed the transept and started up the steps to the altar. Then, suddenly, behind him, he heard heavy running, and turning, he saw them, and the glint of their mail. The clerks had fled. The monks had left their service, and there was silence in the wavering dark. Thomas came back down the steps towards them, and facing them, he put his back against the pillar and stood still. They closed in towards him, groping in the dark. One of them took his sword in hand and crossed the nave towards the south transept to keep the people back. The three came on. And Thomas saw the bulk of shoulders in the dark, a glimmer on the mail, the pointed helmets and the blur of white, their faces cloven by the nasal guards. They came on crouching, arms held wide. Then the first sprang at him, clutching the pallium round his neck, while another reached for his body to lift him off his feet. A sword swung, arched and whistled in the darkness, grazing Thomas's head, knocking his cap off, leaving the tonsure bare. A shout and another sword descended, glanced along the crozier, and Thomas stood wounded, blood on his face. This was his moment. He had chosen it, not Henry. And he died for God alone, no other way. He crossed his hands and bowed his wounded head. Two more blows and Thomas was on his knees, and a third struck him as he fell, so savage that the iron sword broke off against the stones. The men stood back, panting, as their leader looked down at the body and nudged it with his foot. He put his heel upon the neck and thrust his sword point into the broken skull. And swaggering, he walked away.
When the monks lifted up the corpse, they cried out, for underneath it, now revealed where it had been hidden by the fur-lined robe, there lay the broken blade, all blood-stained, of a sword. They lifted the body and went up the steps to the choir, leaving the broken sword, the costly fur-lined cloak, the folded pallium, behind them on the bloody stones. They brought candles and placed him before the altar. Then their voices rose in lamentation for the dead, in praise of this new martyr of the church.
Henry was shattered by Thomas's death. He swore on the Gospels he had not desired it. He made a solemn oath of perpetual obedience to Rome. He made pilgrimages to Thomas's shrine and did public penance. And Becket's sacrifice was not in vain. Until the Reformation, the Church retained the system of ecclesiastical courts independent of the royal authority, and the right of appeal to Rome, two of the major points upon which Becket had defied the king.
But the enigma of Thomas Becket remains. What exactly happened to him when he became Archbishop of Canterbury? Was it simply a question of higher loyalties? Or did he experience something akin to an evangelical conversion, recognizing no master but God? The centuries have not clarified matters, and probably we shall never know.
The dramatization was written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.